Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and our regular co-host Adam Boileau is back from his break, so he will be joining us in just a minute to talk through all the week's security news, and it's great to have Adam back. This week's show is brought to you by CMD Security, the Linux security company, and their focus has been traditionally on restricting the type of bash commands users can enter. It's like a control plane for Linux systems that restricts people by command. But some of their customers manage their Linux endpoints through different non-bash entry points, right? So they've added some features to their products to deal with that, which has resulted in them having an IDR-like capability. But it's all pretty sensible stuff. It's pretty limited, sensible stuff. CMD co-founder and CEO Jake King will be along a little bit later on to talk us through all of that. But first up, let's get into the week's security news now with Adam Boileau. And Adam, welcome back. I hear you had a wonderful time traveling through Middle Earth on your break.
Yeah, it was quite a lot of time spent not thinking about computers and computer hacking, which has been quite pleasant.
Just before we get going on the news, I've got to issue a quick correction for something that happened when you weren't here. So this isn't your fault, but that's okay. last week, we incorrectly said that Signal, the app, doesn't do big groups. And that's wrong. You can have up to 1,000 people in a Signal group. We got a little bit confused because they just announced they'd increased the group size for calls to 8 people. And I got muddled on it, and so did one of our co-hosts. So sorry about that. Yes, you can knock yourself out with Signal groups up to 1,000 people. So there you go. But Adam, we're going to kick things off this week with a bit of a funny story, actually, which started off with a blog post from Tag at Google.
Yes, they reported that some North Koreans appear to be going out and trying to fish people and own them. But the people that they are targeting this time is actually security vulnerability researchers. They've set up some blogs and some fake Twitter personas that purport to be vulnerability researchers. And then they've been reaching out to people via various channels and saying, hey, do you want to collaborate on some vulnerability research? I've got this sweet kernel bug I'm working on. I could do it some help. And then if you fall for the fish, the delivered mechanism is a Visual Studio Code project that has a backdoor in it, which I don't know how many people would have gotten owned by that, but points for trying.
I saw one guy loaded it up in a VM and it bricked his VM. He was like, oh, okay, right. But what's amazing is the sheer number of people on Twitter who are like, oh, I heard from this guy and so did I. And so Silvio and Kylie both were approached. it didn't go anywhere because the whole thing looked so shady, right? It was exactly the sort of approach that you would expect from a North Korean cyber spook, right? It just looked so shady.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. I mean, points for effort. They put their heart into it. It was a solid effort. And I mean, I guess the payoff, right, is if you own some high-profile vuln researcher and you get some sweet bugs, then it might come in handy for something. But it just seems like one of those real, kind of high-risk, high-return sorts of plays. But yeah, maybe they're just jelly because, the Russians got into, FireEye. So they want to go hack some vuln researchers too, steal some sweet bugs.
But it's a story as old as time. Go off and actually hack researchers and get all their sweet booty.
Yeah, although, I guess, the old way of doing it was, you'd have a fake exploit script that would, secretly run the shellcode on the attacker's machine and instead of on the target or something like that. And, that was always kind of black hat on black hat stuff rather than, nation state on black hat and nation state on security researchers. So, yeah, kind of new twist to things.
There was a bit of black hat on white hat stuff back in the day.
That's true. back in the good old days. Points for effort. And there was also some reports that they had a corresponding blog site with some posts and stuff. And there were some reports that people visiting that running fully patched Chrome and Win10 were getting themselves shelled as well. And that's obviously a bit more serious than, just a backdoor Visual Studio project file. Certainly a good reminder that if you work in this industry, that you do have to, keep sharp, keep your powder dry, and be aware that, you are a target.
It's funny seeing the people who are all sad about being left out. They're like, I didn't get approached, am I not important enough? What about me? We saw some threat intel company, I can't remember which one, sorry, it was just kicking around Slack earlier, but they've linked this malware to another campaign, which is, you know, presumably the same people who are doing stuff with malicious documents via LinkedIn and WhatsApp and whatnot. So this is the whole, you know, apply for our job. If you're a security researcher, here are the job requirements, .doc, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly going to work on some people. But yeah, you'd think that security research is going to be a bit more sus than average and you'd have to show up with a pretty, you know, pretty A-game payload. But hey, maybe that's just hubris, right?
Now, Adam, sadly, we need to debunk a story that is doing the rounds. A few people pointed me towards this one. I didn't tweet about it because it just had the whiff of something that was that could both be an urban myth or could be totally true. Just has that vibe to it. But there was this story doing the rounds that when Flash hit end of life and the time bomb thing went off in it and it stopped working, that trains in Dalian in North China stopped running, right? Because apparently they used Flash to control their trains. Then we saw a report from Wired that kind of gave credence to it, but didn't say that the trains had stopped, but didn't say that they didn't stop. And then finally, we got some clarity from Catalin Kimpanu, who looked at the Day 2 reporting out of the Chinese media. Yeah, it turns out it was false, right? But the end of life of Flash did actually affect some of the like stats systems and like information displays that were being used as part of this railroad in China. So yeah, sadly, Flash expiring did not make trains stop. But we do have a couple of interesting things to look at here. And one of them is that the South African Revenue Service has actually published its own browser for so people can still connect to the tax office. And, you know, this one supports Flash. It's not actually as bad a news story as it seems, because you can only use this browser to connect to the South African Revenue Service, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's at least, you know, like if you're going to make this dumb move, that's the smart way to make a dumb move.
Yeah.
So that you can only use the browser for that. Obviously, there's a bunch of reasons why we built apps in, you know, web apps in the first place, so that you can have cross-platform support and use them from mobile devices or whatever. Whereas in this case, you're stuck to, you know, whatever Windows platforms they ship their patched Chromium for. But yeah, given that they've decided to do that rather than just build some new forms for their web app, I guess this is the best way to do a dumb thing.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I can imagine that they would have looked at the shortest path to getting people to submit their tax returns again. And it's like, well, we'll just fork this browser, right? So, I mean, there's got to be a reason.
It's a victory for the open source world that forking the entire of Chromium is easier than redeveloping a, you know, few forms for your web app.
And it's in this story about the South African Revenue Service, which is written by Catalin Kimpanu, that he debunked that those reports from China. So yeah, well done, Catalin. Good work. What else have we got? This is one that we gave it the headline in the newsletter. Well, I gave it the headline in the newsletter. Sonic Wall's dog food bites. Adam, walk us through this one.
So Sonic Wall has come out and said they got themselves owned and perhaps ransomware. We haven't seen details about exactly what happened in terms of ransomware, but yeah, they're saying they got themselves compromised, and they got themselves compromised through vulnerabilities in their own remote access product. Obviously, Sonic Wall makes, you know, a bunch of kind of Soho small biz and sorts of, you know, security products, including remote access VPNs, which were quite famously used by Phineas Fisher, the Shell hacking team.
Well, that was always rumor that I heard at the time, but it never really popped up in reports. And now it is, right? So there we go. It's gone from being sort of lore to being established.
Yeah, and of course, we've actually seen someone subsequently reverse engineer the bug that Phineas Fisher described in another time they owned Sonic Wall. So it does suggest there was some lineage you know, in his ability to shell those kind of products. But anyway, Sonic Wall themselves got themselves owned through their own product, and they've had to put out an advisory telling their customers...
Oh, this is the best bit. This is the best bit.
Telling their customers to, you know, because there's no patch yet, they're still working on it, that they should, for example, IP restrict access to their remote access VPNs.
I mean, I know when I set up a remote access solution, I want to have an allow list that I maintain to determine who can connect to it, because that's really what that sort of product is all about.
Exactly. Oh dear. So yeah, they're pretty bad day over there at Sonic Wall HQ. You know, at least they're not being left out of security vendors getting things owned. But yeah, it's a bit embarrassing when it's your own product getting yourself owned. And whether or not they've actually then been ransomwared, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I think there was a little bit of buzz about like, oh, was this holiday bear hand wavy Russia stuff? You know, but yeah, we don't really know anything about that. It doesn't look like the typical MO, but you never know. Probably, yeah, ransomware crew seems more likely. But it was pretty funny when you read through the Hacking Team ownage. It looks like what they did is they actually completely reflashed that SonicWall device. This is going back, what, to 2015 or whatever. Looks like they completely reflashed the device, but they'd compiled like their tools onto the SonicWall and they used the whole thing as like an attack platform to onwards.
It's a beautiful, you know, it's a beautiful thing.
So cool. And yeah, they just don't use, I mean, SonicWall, you know. SonicWall bad, I think, is the moral of the story.
I think that's the takeaway, yes.
Yes, that's right. Now, we've got a really interesting story here from Jeff Stone over at CyberScoop, sort of putting some details behind what we've always assumed, which is that there is a small number of people sitting at the top of the ransomware business making most of the money. They got a report. They got exclusive access to a report from Chainalysis, which is a company that monitors blockchain stuff, right? So, like, keep in mind, this story certainly serves that company's interests, right? But it's PR at its finest, let's put it that way. And kudos to CyberScoop for being the exclusive outlet and for doing such a good job on the write-up. But, yeah, it looks like these top 1% ransomware operators tend to funnel their Bitcoin transactions, they're laundering through a handful of Tumblrs, which just makes me think, oh, goody, that's a nice target for the US intelligence community, basically.
Yeah, the research is quite interesting. They've pulled together, you know, a set of addresses that they can associate with criminal activity of different sorts, and then they can kind of track that through the blockchain, figure out where it goes, and then try and figure out, you know, whether they're hitting known mixing services, whether they're hitting known entry points for exchanges, and obviously they have some context about how shady the various exchanges are, and then by looking at the volumes flowing in and out, you know, try and build a map of how that money is moving around and what that means. And obviously the conclusion that they've reached is that there is a very small amount of places where you could have quite a big impact, which I think is what you're alluding to there.
Yes.
If you were able to go and get control of that, and obviously, you know, targeting the mechanism for delivery of, you know, the ransoms themselves is definitely one of the good options.
Well, it is and it isn't, because you got to wait till people get their decryption keys that they've paid for. But if you can find the final destination for this stuff, and, you know, I mean, if you're all up in these Tumblrs and you start getting things like IP, I mean, you know, you're going to assume they're going to use Tor and whatnot, but I don't know. They got a few tricks up their sleeves. You just think this would be a good pain point to target, right? If the US government, if US government agencies were, or even, you know, other government agencies from other Five Eyes countries, I mean, they're the ones we know, that's why I'm restricting the conversation to them. But if they were to go after these guys, like, this would be a good way to do it.
Yeah, and especially when, you know, when you're looking at something where it's, you know, there could be thousands and thousands of groups, you know, doing ransomware. When you're looking at a list like this, which is a much smaller set of numbers, it's much more manageable to go and say, oh yeah, we'll just go have a quick look, you know, figure out what those exchanges are, figure out if we can apply any leverage, you know, through, you know, legal means or financial means or, you know, through other mechanisms. Because, I mean, when you're looking at a, you know, a business that's worth what, like, I mean, these guys are tracking something like $400 million worth of transactions, you know, through that they've categorized as criminal, you know, so obviously that's a subset of the overall activity. You know, it's quite a manageable amount of people for a very, you know, quite a good return if you can disrupt it. So I think, you know, if I was one of the operators of a, you know, kind of a marginal exchange site that has a bunch of legit business but also a bunch of not so legit business, which I imagine is probably,
but I think this is
them,
I think this then, is more looking at Tumblrs than exchanges, you know what I mean, like the real proper shady ones.
Yeah, but I mean, if I was the operator of any one of those kinds of, you know, those categories, I'd be probably looking at going like, this is a little bit maybe too much heat going to be coming my way this year.
There's too much margin in laundering people's money, though. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Like, well, that's why they get the big bucks, okay? So I don't think they're going to just have a second thought. I think they need to be spanked first, right? And I can't wait to see it happen because, you know, it sort of reminds me of like a sneakers vibe, you know, steal all their Bitcoin and give it to Greenpeace or something.
You know, well, if someone does that,
which doesn't sound
then,
very U.S. intelligence, know, like a very U.S. intelligence community sort of thing to do. But you never know. We live in hope.
But I mean, don't let that stop you if you want to, you know, USIC.
Now, moving on to another story, and the White House, the new White House, President Grandpa and his team are apparently having a bit of a rethink of what to do about the issue of Chinese social media applications like TikTok. It looks like they're really thinking about, you know, what's a coherent approach to this problem. I've heard Alex Stamos in the past say that what the US needs in response to this issue is laws that govern the way data on US citizens is handled, you know, how that data can be sent across borders and whatnot. They need basically a US GDPR, something, you know, their own framework to deal with these sorts of issues. And it looks like we might be seeing some early rumblings that that's going to happen, but certainly a different approach to, you know, a White House that would just write on bits of paper, "I ban you." So there. It's yeah, weird. It's, I'm not, you know, it's just, it's a different vibe.
It's certainly nice to feel a bit of a different vibe. And, you know, the US does need some kind of coherent nationwide, you know, data privacy policy because, I mean, the current situation is not great for US citizens. And I think, you know, that that is recognized. And we just haven't really had enough momentum, you know, from the leadership to have sensible discussions about that kind of thing. And, yeah, obviously the fact that they've not turned around and said, okay, yes, we're going to totally ban TikTok, that's not a surprise. But hopefully we do end up, you know, moving towards a more sensible, more holistic, you know, more thought out approach than, you know, as you say, just ban TikTok because we don't like it this week.
Yeah. Yeah. So who knows? We might be about to enter a period where there's going to be a bit of a debate on that. So we'll keep you all informed. Dominion voting systems. Oh, man. Like, this is the crazy thing coming out of the Trump era, and then there's still the ripples of it. Dominion voting systems, which has already filed a suit against Donald Trump's former lawyer, Sidney Powell, the conspiracy theorist, former presidential lawyer, Sidney Powell. Yeah, they've also filed a $1.3 billion defamation claim against Rudy Giuliani. I don't, you know, because they were saying that Dominion systems were insecure and somehow conspiring to change the US election result. I don't think this lawsuit is necessarily going to go anywhere, but it's sure going to be a pain in the ass for Rudy.
Yeah, and that, if nothing else comes out of it other than that, then good, good choice. Thank you. You know, voting machine manufacturers don't always do good things, but yeah, suing Rudy Giuliani does seem like a good thing.
There's a bit of a theme in this week's show, right, which is reversals, okay?
Yeah.
So we're seeing a mega corporation file suit against a private individual over something they said, and we're like, lol, that's pretty funny. When usually that happens, it's bad, right? Now, you know, staying in that same vein, the FBI in Washington, D.C. are currently tracking down everyone who had a cell phone near the Capitol on Jan 6, right? And it's crazy. Like, they're turning up to people and saying, yeah, look, you were standing right here at this time. What were you doing there? And, you know, again, this is an interesting thing where, you know, I'd imagine for a lot of people, if the FBI were doing this based on some different type of gathering, they might feel a different way about it, right? So this is me basically hinting at the idea that politics is everything when it comes to these debates. But I suppose we shouldn't be so surprised that the FBI is trying to track everyone down.
No, I mean, and they're going to use all the tools that they have at their disposal. And, like, this is a great example. We have a quite neatly geofenced crime to go and use the tools available to investigate it. But, yeah, you're right. Like, it is, you know, you read it and you think, like, if it was the other way around, right? I mean, if it was being used, you know, against us rather than for us, then, you know, we might be saying different things. But yeah, it's, I don't know, it was just such a weird moment in US history. And, you know, it feels like the responses, you know, of going through the law and order process is kind of what that country needs, you know, to make it through.
Well, they've got to pick apart and find out actually what happened. And if it was just a bunch of derptacular people just sort of getting a little bit loose, or whether or not there was something a little bit more sinister and those people were used. So I guess, you know, the FBI's got its work cut out to try to unpick all of that and find out what happened. But meanwhile, a bunch of people are throwing facial recognition against videos scraped from Parler. And again, this is the sort of thing where if we saw a bunch of fascists doing the same thing to videos that were recorded at a BLM protest or something, you might feel differently about it. This is just another great example of how your politics can color your perception of a news story.
Yeah, now this was an interesting case because it got quite a bit of coverage in mainstream media and stuff. And it was a guy that had, you know, used face detection software to identify faces in a bunch of videos from the US Capitol and then deduplicated it to try and build a map of the people who were there without necessarily saying, you know, we're trying to tie it to specific identities or trying to say, you know, that these people were, you know, were doing something. They were just there at the time. And, you know, kind of you know, there's still a very political aspect to it. And, you know, using, you know, we saw, I think we talked a few years ago about a guy that was like pulling all the video feeds off his like Tesla car and then doing face detection, face recognition off the video that he was collecting. And I think we talked at the time about how kind of creepy that was. And I mean, you know, this is, you know, same set of tools, same kind of creep in a way. But yeah, you're right. Politics is just important and does change what these things mean and how we look at them. And, you know, someone else doing this for a different reason would be totally creepy. But hey, you know, it's 2021, but it's all sorts of weird going on.
Now, we were just talking about that mobile phone location data, an issue that has been mostly spearheaded by the guys over at Vice Motherboard. I mean, this issue is still rolling on. We got a piece here from Shannon Vavra over at Cyberscoop, who has discovered that the Defense Intelligence Agency in the United States has been buying smartphone location data, you know, purchased from commercially available databases. I mean, this is just, we're just finding out more and more about this. It looks like it's standard operating procedure for a bunch of organizations that frankly should know better.
Yeah, but you know, on the other hand, it works, right? And it's probably quite cost effective, you know, versus, you know, tasking, you know, intelligence agencies to go and get it.
You can just but when the intelligence agencies have to go get it, they need to go through some sort of process. When the FBI wants to get it, they need to go through some sort of process. When you buy it from like Bob's Marketing Solutions, you don't have to go through that process. That's the problem.
You go through like a spending money process. Sure. But you know, you're right. There's a, you know, the Americans do need to kind of think overall about how they expect privacy to work. Right, and there's so much good data collected by some of these companies, and yeah, people are going to buy it and going to use it. I think in this case, the Defense Intelligence Agency mostly were buying it about overseas persons, and there was a kind of a pretty small subset that was actually American citizens, but non-zero, right, which is the important thing for the Americans.
Now, look, moving on to a quick discussion about the SolarWinds, Holiday Bear, hand-wavy Russia stuff campaign. We've got a report here in the New York Times that contains a fabulously hilarious, unintentionally hilarious paragraph, Adam.
The report says that intelligence officials have quietly concluded that more than 1,000 Russian software engineers were most likely involved in the attacks, which... I mean, there may well have been 1,000 people involved on the Russian side, in which case, you know, good job, because those project managers, they certainly earned their keep.
Yeah, it look, this factoid was the subject of of some memeing on Twitter since the publication of this story. This story is really looking at how, you know, the White House is considering how to respond, right? And they're like, someone has told David Sanger at the New York Times that there were 1,000 Russian software engineers. Now, you know, are they saying that SVR has 1,000? Are they saying that, you know, Russian intelligence services combined have 1,000? Are they saying that 1,000 people are in this unit of SVR? We don't know, but it's unlikely that 1,000 Russian software engineers actually worked on a bit of malware, right?
I mean, it is, but it does make for such a good, you know, such a good laugh, and lots of Mythical Man Month jokes on Twitter and InfoSec Twitter ensued, and everyone had a good time, you know, making fun of that.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the FSB in Russia is warning Russians that, you know, the big bad Americans are coming to attack them.
Yes, they've been warned. They're warning of counterattacks based on, you know, statements that the US made, like vague statements that they might respond to time and place if they're choosing. So yeah, the Russians are being warned to do a bunch of, you know, quite sensible things. The advice published by the Russian government was actually quite sensible, much like you would expect. You know, turn on multi-factor auth and you know, consider patching your stuff unless it's SolarWinds. And yeah, so you know, good advice to Russians if you are, you know, in that business over there, then definitely patch your stuff and turn on multi-factor. After all.
If it seems reasonable. Now, I just wanted to link through to a post from Lawfare that we kind of missed when it first popped up, and it's very relevant to what we're talking about. This post was published on January 15, and it's by Kieran Martin, who is the founder of the UK's NCSC. He left there last year, and these days he is Professor of Practice in the Management of Public Organisations at the University of Oxford. He wrote this really great, slightly peeved post for Lawfare that basically says he's sick and tired of governments saying we will respond to deter cyber adversaries and will respond in a time and a place of our choosing. Exactly that line that you just brought up. And, you know, basically if we were to paraphrase what Kieran's saying is he's basically arguing that when governments say that there will be a response, it's sort of like the government equivalent to we take your security very seriously, okay? It's turned into completely meaningless politician speak for, oh, we're going to do something, but it's all going to happen in the shadows and don't worry your pretty little heads. And I just think this post, I found it very, very insightful. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I also thought it was quite insightful. I mean, the sort of tautological aspect of it, like where you've got a response, whether we're going to respond and there will be a response, and we're going to, just kind of left unsaid as to what that response is. And that way you can always claim that you've responded or that, something has happened, in a way that, people don't necessarily see. And in the cyber world, that's very, very easy to do, right? Because there's so much that happens in the shadows and we don't necessarily see it. And he makes this kind of comparison to the, like, Brexit means Brexit, where obviously Brexit means whatever you choose it to mean. So everybody is kind of equally satisfied and unsatisfied at the same time. And that kind of non-speak is what he's, is the accusation he's leveling at the way that we talk about responding to, attempting to deter, activity by other, other actors.
He's just railing against this line of we will impose costs to deter our adversaries because it is meaningless.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, maybe like if it was going to work, like if we were deterring, our adversaries from doing something, perhaps they would be deterred by now. And it's kind of hard to say because everything's so kind of cloaked in shadow. But yeah, it's just, I thought it was pretty good policy wonkery.
Yeah, me too. So that a link to that is in this week's show notes. It's not a particularly long post, but yeah, definitely worth a read. We've got another report here from ZDNet. 2.28 million members of a dating site called Meet Mindful have had their stuff dumped online. Thankfully, no direct messages.
Yeah, thankfully, but a bunch of other stuff, IP addresses and that long records from GeoIP when people logged in, hashed passwords, and Facebook, correlated Facebook IDs and auth tokens.
The auth tokens bit was the interesting part, I thought.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot of auth tokens, man.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think the data dump is still available. I haven't actually looked at it myself, but it is still kicking around. So, yeah, if you've used that, then probably it's time to go and, make sure that your Facebook accounts aren't linked still to the service and, any other details that are relevant. I mean, it's not like you can change your date of birth, but hey, it's good to know, I suppose.
Apropos of nothing, if I were a single man, I think Meet Mindful would be the last place I would go looking for love because it sounds like the membership base would compose exclusively of annoying hippies.
As a hippie-looking gentleman, I take offence.
Do you lecture people about mindfulness? Because I live on the north coast of New South Wales, my friend. And let me tell you.
Yeah. A little more triggering for you, yes. My
now, okay, we're gonna talk about this one quickly because this is just very funny. Intel says that a infographic pertaining to its financial results was like hacked. Or leaked, right? And as a result, they had to publish their market statement early because someone had accessed this infographic, which contained some, top line numbers in it. I'm guessing, and this story doesn't say, but I'm guessing that they put this stuff on their website with a predictable URL and someone grabbed it. Is that your vibe here as well?
That's certainly what it feels like. Or one of the kind of equivalent things, where you put it on in draft, but it gets indexed by the search engine or, some other variant of, we half published it when we didn't mean to, which, we've seen a bunch of people do that kind of thing over the years. And yeah, that fits. And then, hacked in scare quotes is a great excuse, when that goes wrong for you.
And it's an excuse as old as time, because another link that we've got in this week's show notes is a link to a story that appeared on ZDNet.com in October of 2002. It was written by a tremendously talented young journalist by the name of Patrick Gray, and a Swedish software company called Intentia also accused a party of hacking its results. They accused Reuters of hacking their results because Reuters were able to actually just guess the URL for their corporate results, grab it and get a piece up. This day one piece was just about the accusation. And then I wrote a day two piece it's dropped out of Google. I couldn't find it. But, a variation of this same story I wrote nearly 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, this, it happens all the time. Happened to, what was it, our budget last year when our opposition party helped themselves to the bunch of details out of the cache or something like that. Yeah, so it happens all the time.
But it's not hacking. Okay? If you publish something, it hasn't been hacked when someone accesses it. There's even case law on this, If it's got a password on it, if it's in a password-protected directory and someone bypasses the control, they've hacked it. When they didn't bypass it, a URL is not a control.
I concur. I too like direct object references.
Now, this next one Every now and then you hear about a new DDoS reflection technique. And this one, I got to admit, kind of surprised me. People are using RDP as a reflection vector for DDoS attacks. What? Can you even, you can throw UDP at RDP and it answers? Really?
So yeah, it's quite interesting. In Windows 8 and later, so like RDP version 8 and later, they added support for UDP transport. So yeah, you can use, instead of the normal TCP 3389, you can use UDP 3389.
But why?
So their assertion is that it works better on congested networks, and they have a bunch of like forward error correction and stuff, so you don't have to retransmit, which is quite smart.
It is, I guess, if you're in a part of the world that has shitty internet, then.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, you know, there were some reasons why they wanted to do that, but yeah, I was surprised. I didn't realize there was a UDP version of MSRDP until now, but yeah, it turns out there is. Fortunately, I guess most people who firewall it probably don't know either. So, you know, people aren't letting TCP through. But yeah, if you had bare Windows boxes on the internet, of which, you know, is a thing that happens, then yeah, apparently you could be traffic amped. And the amp ratio was like something like, it was 85 to 1 or something. Like it was pretty significant. So there's been reports of, you know, like many, many gigabits of DDoS traffic being amped in this way. So yeah, useful vector, I guess.
Attack of the RDP servers. There you go. Who'd have thunk it? Woke up this morning to discover that Apple has fixed 3 iOS 0 days that are being exploited in the wild. That's the sort of news that makes you hit the old update button pronto.
Yeah, definitely get updating. It was a kernel Prevesk plus a couple of WebKit bugs, you know, chained together to make a, you know, working exploit chain, which is really not what we look for in iOS phones. But it's been, you know, it was a pretty busy year for the Apple security team. Last year in this, so yeesh.
Yeesh. And meanwhile, SAP admins might want to look out.
I mean, they're always having a bad day, so like nothing new for them. But no, this was someone published exploit code for a bug in one of the SAP components that's essentially just there's no auth. If you can talk to the service, then you can run code on connected machines. So yeah, it's pretty much pre-auth RCE against the SAP authentication component. So good job, SAP, good job. And being weaponized, has been weaponized and being actively scanned for. So yeah, I think if you are a SAP admin with this particular thing exposed, the solution manager, nice, you know, detailed name there, then yeah, you're probably already wrecked. So instant response time.
Woo! This one probably should have appeared elsewhere in the run sheet, but we're just going to roll on anyway. There's a trashy crypto mining malware crew called MRB Miner, and they're Iranian, and they have done basically nothing to hide who they are, and it's quite funny. I mean, this is what happens when you don't have an extra, you know, they're not going to get extradited, so they're just you funneling C2 traffic to their company domain.
Exactly, right to their corporate website, which is, you know, hey, I mean, I guess they're not committing a crime in Iran. So, you know, what have they got to fear?
Yeah,
don't go on holiday anywhere else.
I mean, I doubt it even makes much money because, I mean, crypto miners don't really make that much anymore, do they?
Like, you wouldn't think so. But hey, maybe they don't have huge aspirations. Like maybe they only need a few things.
Maybe it's a sort of simple
things in life.
Yeah, maybe it's an academic exercise or something. Just a bit of a project, bit of a curiosity. Got a couple of little stories here that I found interesting. This one's cool. This is a kind of YouTube bug. It's like an info leak that would allow you to get someone's playlists and view history if you can get them to load a YouTube player in a browser. You're better at explaining this stuff, but it's cool research.
Yeah, so essentially the trick here is on a page that's embedding the YouTube player, so it can play videos off YouTube inside somebody else's website. As the website's instantiated that, you have some ability to query the like iframe object and ask it questions about, you know, play it and pause it and all that kind of thing. Anyway, the things that you've watched on YouTube are in like a hidden playlist, and same with your like things you want to watch or whatever else. And so you can. You could, until someone reported this, you could command the embedded player to play these hidden playlists, and then you could introspect it as it was playing to see what it was playing. And so you could get, for example, unlisted videos out of the, because there's the playlist for all of the videos that you as the user have uploaded to YouTube. So essentially, it's kind of classic confused deputy sort of attack where, you know, the embedded thing is authed as you, but is being controlled by a third party. And yeah, you could use that to learn things about people's YouTube habits.
Yeah, I just thought it was fun, right? Because you would think they would have thought of this and they hadn't, and he got it, and it's very cool.
And he got a $1,337 bounty for it.
So which seems a little low, but anyway, money's money, so that's all right. Now, we mentioned TikTok briefly earlier. There's a bit of API stupidity here that allows an attacker to enumerate the phone numbers of users, which probably not the best.
Yeah, and this feels like one of those things that's kind of a poorly thought out interaction between the kind of contact sharing, content, you know, friend discovery process, and the fact that, you know, there's a mechanism to then go and query that data, you know, through the application. And actually getting to the point where you can make those API calls was a bit fiddly, but I mean, that's just a thing for mobile, you know, device app reverse engineers to go through, which people have done. But yeah, it does seem kind of poorly thought through. And I'm not sure whether it's expected behavior or a bug. Like, it feels kind of like expected, but I'm not, you know, of the age group that TikToks quite so much. So I'm not really sure.
Hey man, don't knock it. TikTok's great. TikTok's hilarious. But it just is that sort of Instagram set where you've got people who pop up who have like huge followings. I mean, they're basically celebrities, you know what I mean? And there's a lot of creepers out there, and that's what makes me think this one's pretty bad. And we've seen some interesting sort of little examples of API abuse recently. One that happened when you were away was the Telegram one, where you could use its distance between users thing, and you could sort of spoof your location until you could triangulate the location of a user. So we're just seeing people pay more and more attention to finding stuff like this, and it just makes you wonder how much other stuff just hasn't been found, right?
Yeah, I mean, these are pretty kind of classic application sorts of like logic bugs rather than, you know, the more traditional security things. And yeah, that idea of, you know, triangulating users based on distance, like that's just, you know, chef kiss, good stuff. So, you know, I'm sure lots of smart people will come up with clever, you know, other clever tricks.
And meanwhile, this next piece is a great example of why the earlier one's a problem, which is someone has scraped, 5 years ago, someone scraped a whole bunch of phone numbers and matched them to Facebook IDs, and now they're selling access to that information, according to this piece by Joe Cox over at Motherboard.
Yeah, 500 million users worth of Facebook phone records, from half a decade ago. But, you know, a lot of people still have the same number. That's, you know, important data, even if it is 5 years out of date. And yeah,
but that's the thing. That's why I included this, because I've had the same phone number for God, like a long time, decades, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, me too, right? Exactly. And, you know, Facebook's always been a bit kind of weird about collecting that data in the first place. And then when they go ahead and lose it, it kind of really does rub your nose in exactly that. So, yeah, boo.
Now let's talk about something that's making news in Australia, which is a bug in a product called Accelion. Now, this is some sort of weird large file transfer system for enterprise. Is that right? Tell us what Accelion is.
Yeah, so Accelion's a company that makes a number of products. One of them is their file transfer appliance, FTA, which is a thing you run on your network and you use it to share files. So it's kind of like, you know, enterprise Dropbox or, you know, that sort of thing for just sharing big files around the place. That particular product has had a somewhat checkered security history. There's been a bunch of bugs in it over the years. There was a post-auth SQL injection that was exploited on a bunch of deployments of that in early January. A bunch of people had data taken. Some of those organizations are, you know, struggling with what that might mean because we don't know where the data has gone.
So, yeah, I mean, it looks like this is a pretty major trash fire. A bunch of people are affected. The communications out of this company, Accelion, like we covered this in the newsletter yesterday. Go subscribe, everyone. Don't forget to subscribe. We had a look at it and, yeah, their comms on this have been pretty bad. They're like, we patched a bug in a thing. You know, install a patch. that's your details, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've had some experience with them. I've found a few bugs, owned a few people through some Accelion products over the years. And so we've had some interaction with them as a company. And it wasn't always a pleasant process of, you know, disclosing bugs to them, that kind of thing. So that kind of matches my experience. I'm not sure. Like, this bug was a little complicated because it was post-auth and a whole bunch of unrelated, you know, users running this product all got popped all at once. And obviously they don't have the same user account.
Yeah, you got to think, well, how did that happen?
Perhaps there is some more to the story that we're not really kind of sure what's happened here. But the vendor themselves have said, like, the product is end of life. You should move to one of our new products, which I'm sure are better.
That seems a little bit like sarcasm there, but anyway. they did go after some decent targets like the Reserve Bank of New Zealand and I think the Australian Corporate Regulator. So, yeah, it wasn't just like, it didn't feel very random, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and the fact that a bunch of people got hit all at once, and I don't know whether that correlated with Accelion patching the bug out, for example. Like, I'm not sure what the trigger was for that, but yeah, certainly there was a bunch of people got themselves a bunch of own through a bug in a crappy old product that probably, you know, should have been end of life by the vendor, you know, a long time ago.
Now, a late breaking story, and this is your sort of jam. Sudoomageddon! Woo!
So much my jam. Yeah, we woke up this morning and there was a brand new sudo bug. Sudo is a tool on Unix platforms for escalating privilege. It's the main way that, you know, administrative users gain root level access on their Unix boxes. So any bug in sudo is a big deal. And there's been a few bugs over the years, but by and large, they haven't been, you know, really bad ones. Some researchers over at Qualys, however, came up with a really, really solid bug. Like, default configuration sudo. You don't have to have your local user account configured to be in sudo, and you can gain root privilege through a memory corruption bug in sudo, which is just, you know, it's super smooth, beautiful bug, applies to modern Unix. So that's pretty good. It's a lovely bug.
It is. It is indeed. Hey, I keep noticing you're calling it sudo. I always thought it stood for super user do. So that's why I call it sudo.
Yeah, I call it sudo, but, you know, tomato, whatever.
But who's right?
I mean, probably you're right. Probably sudo is what the author intended, but...
Now, yo, dog, I heard you like Stack Overflow. So I used Stack Overflow to own your Stack Overflow.
Yes. So back in 2019, Stack
Overflow. This is a new story. We should tell people. That was my curious way of setting up a new story. But Adam, do go on.
Yes, back in 2019, Stack Overflow got themselves owned, and the source code to Stack Overflow, the site, was stolen. And they obviously investigated that at the time. They published a couple of days ago a post-mortem write-up of their investigation of this intrusion. It's actually really, really interesting because, A, you know, they're kind of quite a cloudy company, and so how you investigate incidents in a cloud environment across multiple services is really interesting. B, they had really good log data, and they pulled together, you know, all of their front-end logs to figure out how the attacker was accessing their things and built a timeline. And one of the really funny things, of course, is that they found the attacker in question searching Stack Overflow to figure out how to, you know, use some of the products that he had compromised, or he or she had compromised, in their environment. So yeah, they use Stack Overflow to learn how to own Stack Overflow.
When you think about it, like, there's probably a great counterintelligence opportunity by just being all over Stack Overflow.
I mean, oh yeah. I mean, people look up all sorts of great stuff. I mean, I know I've done that. Like, you pop a shell on some piece of software you've never seen, and, you know, you Google it, and there's, you know, usually a Stack Overflow thread about it, and off you go. Yeah, it'd be a great place to go.
Although, we have seen examples of malware authors and even APT crews, like, their Stack Overflow questions popping up, like, you know, FireEye reports and whatnot. Yes, yes. I just love that they used a Game of Thrones meme in this, which is at the end, and it's one does not simply, you know, that one. One does not simply break into Stack Overflow without constantly looking up how to do so on Stack Overflow, which is quite nice. But that's a good read, that one.
It's a Lord of the Rings meme.
Sorry, what did I say? Game of Thrones.
You said Game of Thrones.
Nerd shit with swords. What do you want?
No, fair enough. It's only as a New Zealander, I'm honour bound to point out Lord of the Rings.
You are. Well, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you back again, my friend, and we'll do it all again next week.
Yeah, it's a good time. I will see who gets on next week and we can talk all about it. Good times, good times.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. And before I move on to the sponsor interview, I just wanted to ask the audience to tweet at me about something. Last week, we spoke about how Caesar was recommending organizations block ads within their environments. And we said, you know, that's great, but how are you going to do that? Running ad blockers can be risky, et cetera, et cetera. A listener pointed out that Edge, Microsoft Edge, has a bunch of anti-tracking features that can disrupt ads in browsers. But my question is there a security benefit in doing it with the default Edge functionality, or is that more about stopping tracking, right? Because I just don't understand, because I don't run an enterprise environment, right? So do tweet at me, please. I am Risky Business, one word, on Twitter. And I am, I'm curious to know if you can actually use that that native functionality to actually block ads in your environment. Let me know. Okay, it's on to this week's sponsor interview now. And this week's show is brought to you by CMD Security. Their solution is all about being able to observe and control the commands entered in at the command line across your Linux fleet. So you can use their software as like an extra permissions layer. Think of it like that. And that helps to detect or restrict lateral movement in your environment and also helps to add some seatbelts to your Linux environment so admins can't make catastrophic mistakes. But yeah, what if your users are not using Bash? What if you're using some fancy schmancy Linux fleet management tool that bypasses normal shells? Well, enough people are managing their Linux boxes via these alternative entry points that CMD has added a bunch of IDR-like functionality to its product so it can catch suspicious stuff regardless of the entry point. CMD Security CEO Jake King joined me to talk all about that, and here he is.
We released a series of eBPF-based telemetry products last year that gave us a bit of an insight, you know, not publicly visible, but it gave us a bit of an insight into the alternative entry points that are on systems. Mike Sample and I talked about it last time we were on the show, where we talked about alternative entry points, the HashiCorp boundary entry point, the different ways that teams are accessing systems. And this, in turn, let us look at alternative processes. What's Nginx doing when it forks and it starts to run a series of file changes? What about a PHP web application that's now starting to make exec calls? We'd started to dip our toes into the water of analyzing these behaviors, and then applying some of those same constraint technologies that we developed to what you can see within, these entry points.
This is interesting, right? Because, you know, initially the pitch behind CMD was really about like, okay, someone's on the box, they got a shell, and locking that down where it wouldn't really do much about someone like exploiting a service, right? Where they're going to be loading their own shell into memory and whatever. And it sounds like you're sort of, you know, heading down that path, which is... You know, it's a more complicated product, that's for sure. I mean, you're starting to sound a little bit like EDR for Linux, Jake. I hate to say it.
Oh, man. I know. They're not endpoints, Pat, so we've got to be careful about that terminology. But what I will say is, the fundamental difference is we're not coming at this from a blind kind of tactic endpoint, of what's going on in an endpoint. Generally, production workloads, staging workloads, development workloads, running Linux... running Linux as an underlying operating system are relatively consistent until something changes. Even containers are relatively consistent until something changes. And applying some of those same technologies to constrain potentially what an application can do from a capability standpoint certainly interests us. And, you know, alongside a lot of the research that we'd done in 2020, we were finding that adversaries are starting to get a little bit more sophisticated when it comes to Linux. You know, we're finding that our technology is maturing as the adversary's, approaches to attacking the technology improves as well. And it's not to say we haven't seen any of these kind of sophisticated entry points in the past. Obviously, remote code execution through web applications has been a thing for a while. But what we're finding is we've improved the controls to defend against those kind of attacks quite robustly. It's really the actions on objectives that an adversary takes when that exploit's actually successfully made that we're helping organizations start to get a bit of a handle around with some of our eBPF product lines. And it's our hope that we can take some of those sensible controls that aren't noisy, that aren't going to blow up production, that aren't going to overwhelm an engineer, and apply it in a responsive methodology first and then in a proactive methodology as we start to mature.
But this is a substantial change, right? From the CMD traditional pitch, which is like, really that pitch was much more about locking down things like mistakes in production. Some of your clients actually use your software to just put some constraints on junior engineers doing dumb things, right? In prod, right? Also designed to kind of stop certain forms of lateral movement, right?
Yeah.
But now you're pushing into this other much more nuanced area where you've got to start worrying about things like your false negatives, your false positives, your signal to noise. Am I going to be, doing crazy stuff? Is my security solution going to be blocking production assets when they shouldn't be? Like, this is a big push for you.
Yeah, it takes a lot of confidence to apply any kind of constraint to applications running on a Linux system. And when you think about entry points, you know, that a user may make, being SSH, starting bash, and entering a system session, you know, we're able to apply that same constraint and control in the same way. What's become very interesting for us is this is not a snap change in an overnight kind of push towards, hey, we're going to block, you know, sudo for starting this program, or we're going to change what this capability is on a system. We're allowing our organizations that currently use the software to really expand that viewing point to alternative, you know, kind of processes running on the host, and then gradually maturing those capabilities.
Yeah. So what happens if some attacker rolls up, you know, winds up with a meterpreter session via some sort of memory corruption exploit on, you know, on a Linux box on which your agent is installed? I mean, is that the sort of stuff that you're looking for?
We definitely want to start with, you know, kind of more common, more nuanced attacks that we can, you know, better understand the entry point mechanism.
So give me some examples. That's what I'm after.
Let's think remote code execution vulnerability inside an application, or a privilege escalation vulnerability inside a binary running on the system that might involve some kind of, you know, process fork, and then, you know,
privesc is going to be easy to spot, right? Like that's, yeah.
Exactly. Really taking the idea of really our best-in-class visibility for user behavior and again, just zooming that lens out a little bit to holistically monitor the system, you'll start to see a lot of this language change in you know, some of the capabilities that you see us releasing this year. And I think what's most interesting about some of these changes is, as I said, you know, this has really been having access to this much broader, much more, you know, rich set of data from the host that's coming out of our eBPF sensor these days. And it's certainly been enlightening for us to see the kind of interesting behavior that some of our systems are seeing. Yeah.
doesn't look right. And that's going to be an easy signature. It'd be, yeah. So yeah, you're just going to pick off, you're picking off the easy stuff first, right? Which makes sense.
I mean, look, we want to look at this in a reasonable way. You know, what's the adversary going to try and approach for, you know, a company with 500 employees and 15 developers managing an infrastructure fleet? You know, they're not going to be using the incredibly sophisticated chained exploit to try and enter that system.
You gave another example, which was like a web application vulnerability being exploited or whatever. Like how do you deal with that from, you know, your product's perspective?
You know, today, you know, the idea for CMD again was to focus on entry points we could clearly articulate inside the platform. We've always had a broader capability of being able to detect things within, inside, say, a PHP process running, you know, as the exec, and, you know, bash being started, and, you know, some horrible thing happening as a payload's dropped. We want to gain clarity around a lot of what those entry points look like for our end users, create, you know, some different policies, some different procedures to make that easier to detect and initially respond to, you know, eventually kind of getting some of those constraint points in as we gain confidence in how people are using our response.
But I'm just wondering what the general approach would be to catching that scenario, because that is really a common one.
Yeah. Really, really the exploit detection for, say, a web application vulnerability would be looking for processes spawned underneath, say, you know, PHP in that case.
Yeah, okay.
Can we detect bash starting? Can we observe the executions that are happening under bash, or, you know, SH?
So
or
this TSH. is really just looking at, yeah, processes, right? Sort of like when exactly. Immunity released its El Jefe tool like 10 years ago. I'm sure you're familiar with it, right?
Absolutely. It's definitely a broader approach to our technology. And I think the beautiful thing about it is we became, you know, experts in visualizing the data we were collecting. And as we started to expand that coverage footprint of what we could observe, we have learned an absolute boatload about how systems react under exploit, under duress, how, you know, administrators operate those systems, what they tend to be doing. And, you know, this in no way means that we kind of shift a lot of the policies and the frameworks and the focus of how customers can use the technology today. If you want to, you know, add multi-factor authentication to a privilege escalation inside a native shell, it's still our intent to keep those constraints in place. But it's really about saying, can we defend the system in a holistic way? And a lot of this was stemmed from alternative entry points being used. You know, let's look at, you know, Gravitational's teleport product. You're not coming in through SSH, you're coming in through a process running on the system. That process is enacting executions on your behalf. You know, same with SSM from AWS. These are different entry points that are not your standard kind of...
Yeah, it's like corporate approved malware, basically, from your point of view, right?
You know,
that's what it looks like.
The challenge around it is, you know, we as administrators, you have developed a repertoire of tools that they like to orchestrate and manage their fleet with. We've had to expand our coverage to monitor alternative entry points. CVPF was a convenient way of being able to do it.
Yeah, it makes much more sense. Like this move makes more sense when you're like, well, not everyone uses Bash. You know, like that's it.
Not everyone uses the standard entry point.
No. That just makes it a lot clearer what you've been saying about these alternative entry points. It's a lot clearer when you actually name the tools. You know.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the more we get into it, the more you can expect to see some of that response capability added to the platform. And I think, you know, as we start to mature as an organization, you know, thanks to a lot of your listeners, thanks to a lot of the folks that have been using the free product for a long time now, we have truly understood behavior on Linux in a relatively holistic way for a while. And a lot of that's allowed us to minimize the noise of alerts, to maximize the value on entry point triggers, different triggers and different policies that we can use to fire off alternative events. And in turn, you know, provide a real-time view for you know, security operators.
You're gonna move into like the orchestration side where you could just, you know, pointy clicky button and it's remediation. I mean, what do you mean by response?
No, I don't think we're going to get to a point of remediation from a click button. But you know what? What I'd love to be able to do is, you know, interrupt a process running on a system, you know, invoke a series of constraint or control kind of behaviors in a similar way that our current policy framework starts to work today. And again, listen to our customers. You know, the way that we want to work from you know, expanding these capabilities is through our current customers and prospective customers and learn how we actually have to defend these systems. It's fundamentally different to the way you manage an endpoint.
So thankfully, it doesn't sound like you're actually trying to boil the ocean here and say, we provide the most comprehensive detections for anything and install us, and then you're going to add machine learning fairy dust to it. It's more like saying, well, look, there's going to be some pretty common things that are obviously bad and we're going to pick up on them.
Absolutely. And I think in many ways, a lot of the approaches to trying to secure infrastructure have been an undertaking of trying to boil the ocean.
Yes.
The amount of times we've come into an organization who's just struggling to solve shared account access and privileged access and every single process on the system, as well as OS patching and management and maintenance and everything under the sun at the same time, you set yourself up for failure. You know, our recommendation is, you know, Central 8's pretty decent. Try and tick off a number of the boxes as you go.
Yeah. And you're going to do what you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of what we've found, at least over the last couple of months, as we've really started to collect some of this kind of more broad system information, is, hey, people can use the controls that we have to really effectively defend out the systems we're installed upon, and truly make a difference when it comes to defending the systems that we're running in prod.
All right, Jake King, it's been a real pleasure to chat to you, my man. Always good to see your face, and I'll chat to you again soon.
Thanks again, Pat.
That was Jake King there from CMD Security. Check them out at cmd.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in a few days with a Soapbox Edition talking to the founders of Material Security. And that one is super interesting, by the way, so do make sure you listen to it. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.